Everyone, thanks for joining us on another episode of The Catholic Gentleman. I am so blessed that you have decided to join us. I have a great man and a filmmaker, producer, writer who's joining us today on this show to talk about one of my favorite saints, Saint Maximilian Kolbe. He is somebody that's been close to my heart and with me for really the last 12, 14 years of my life, somewhere around there, so much so that my second son is named after Stephen, the first martyr, and Maximilian Kolbe, the a great martyr as well. So I'm just so blessed to be joined by Anthony D'Ambrosio today. Like I said, I think I called him a producer, but I guess he's more of a director and writer. You can clarify all that, Anthony. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, and I'm super grateful to be on this podcast. I've been, like, you know, following it for a long time and looking for my opportunity to get on it. So this is an honor.
Well, I appreciate that very much. And I tell you what, this is such a great opportunity because I was blessed to be able to go to that kind of pre-screening, kind of like, you know, a thank you session on Friday night. And I was overwhelmed by the work that you're doing and the creativity that you are bringing to it. And I did. I found this beautiful connection between how St. Maximilian Kolbe evangelized and what you're doing, right? Because he was so creative. It wasn't just become an apologist and you know, create YouTube. Well, maybe create YouTube videos, you know, maybe he would have done that back then. But there was this real heart of creativity in how he was evangelizing and how he's hunting after souls. And I see you're doing the same thing.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things that's so interesting about Kolbe is that he really was the first saint that to embrace modern media and to be thinking forwardly about cinema and its use for evangelization. And before anybody else was thinking about the use of movies, he was already starting to get the idea for putting together like a film studio, you know? So this guy was somebody who had a lot of ambition for how to bring the gospel to the world. And of course, the really beautiful paradox of his life is that even though he made one of the biggest publications in Poland at the time, that he really is known in his legacy for a very small act of love that was heroic and that was self-sacrificial and that was really portraying the heart of the gospel just in his own action. So I think that's a really beautiful thing to kind of kick it off with is regardless of the creativity, the action of the Christian is like the most important.
Thanks be to God, Anthony. I really appreciate that. And yeah, you're right, because Maximilian Kolbe is known for the end of his life, but not necessarily all of the phenomenal work that he did between. And I'll say, yeah, The Catholic Gentleman Plus, we don't require, but it is the strong suggestion that everybody takes the Maximilian Kolbe Marian Consecration Prayer before they dive into all the stuff we're doing over there. And I'll say that he elevated my understanding of Mother Mary, of the Immaculata, you know, turning from the Saint Louis de Montfort, where it was a slave to Mary, to now, honestly, Maximilian Kolbe upping at a level where I'm just an instrument to of Mary's, you know, an instrument of her grace. And all of that in between was just so powerful. I get his daily emails, well, the Militia Immaculata's daily emails with quotes from him, and they just edify me every day. So I just am so grateful. And actually, with that, tell us a little bit about your relationship with this phenomenal saint and your life and how that all came to be and how you learned to fall in love with him before we go on to this incredible movie that you're working on.
Yeah, thank you. I guess I'll start with saying that as a young man who was grew up in the church, I had certainly been familiar with his story and at least in a tertiary way, like the pictures of him. And I actually had a sort of a bad taste in my mouth. I really didn't like him. I wasn't attracted to him, partly because of sort of the austerity of the photos. Like, he just always looks stern at the camera, you know, and also just some of the militant language that I had read from him just didn't resonate with me as more of like a St. Francis type follower that's like, you know, into the brother, son, sister, moon kind of thing. And I really was, it didn't click to me until later in my life. After I went to seminary, I had a health crisis that really kind of brought me to my knees, and it caused me to lose the relationship that I thought the woman that I thought I was going to get married to, and a lot of the future that I had planned for myself. It caused really extreme insomnia, which meant that I just couldn't function like a normal person for a very long time. And so I didn't know when that would end, if it ever would. And I was really angry with God and very jaded, I guess, about like the Christian life. It felt to me like, at least in the way that I had thought about it before, it was like, if you follow God and you are doing his commandments and you're in good grace and you're, you know, discerning well, and you seek the vocation that God is calling you, then ultimately, like, you will be given that vocation. You'll be given the good things that God wants you to have. If he wants us to have joy and life at the fullest, then he'll give those things to us. Right. And, my experience was that wasn't the case, you know? And I was given, what felt like a very meaningless cross that just kind of took me off the rails from a life that I thought was going to be effective for the Lord and for the gospel. And instead I was just sort of bedridden without any real like thing that I could do with that. And
if I could, how long ago was that? What are we talking about? Time frame?
Yeah. This was about 2014. Okay. Yeah. 2013, 14. And so I was in that place of anger, and God, in sort of a funny way, I feel like he used that liminal space between wake and sleep that insomniacs dwell in, to start bringing me into these meditations about St. Maximilian Kolbe. And, I don't know exactly where they came from, but, the sense of being in a cell, like being in a prison cell and starving to death, was something that I really related to. And the question that I feel like, was being presented to these men in Auschwitz, frankly, the question of suicide was presented to them the second that they got in. I think the Nazis really wanted to and almost like relished in breaking the human spirit. And so for them, they wanted to see these people like end their own lives. It was almost like a game to them. And so for the people who were in the cell, that would have been in some ways the norm. They were expected to live maybe 2 days tops. Wow. And there were all sorts of horrible stories from people who cleared out other cells that were punished with the same punishment of cannibalism and of suicide. So for Kolbe to be in the cell with these other men where that would have been the norm, and for him to get them to stay alive for 14 days, not all of them lived that long, but some of them made it all the way with him and were executed with him, is quite frankly a miracle. And I think that I felt like there was something there for me to learn. Like, whatever he was doing, he gave them meaning and gave them a reason to live in the midst of something that where they already knew they were condemned to die. There was no like happy ending that they had to live for, but somehow they still had hope, and Kolbe was able to give that to them. And so as I was meditating on his conversations with these men, in some way I was kind of like having conversations with him myself. And it felt like to me that he was stepping into my cell because he could understand the suffering that I was going through and was able to help pull me out of that and into hope.
Oh, glory, praise be to God. Wow, Anthony, every time, yeah, I'm moved by your story, and I really appreciate you sharing that. So for those of our listeners here who are diving in who don't really know the story of St. Maximilian Kolbe, I'd love for you to share just the kind of a general understanding, as long as you want to, about who this great saint was, a modern saint of our times, and a saint that, as you have already mentioned, you know, projected heroism. You know, he projected, obviously, he showed us the devotional life. I mentioned his love for Our Lady. You have also brought up love, you know, just in general, and obviously hope, that I know we'll get to, or I hope we will get to. No pun intended. Why don't you share a little bit about the life of St. Maximilian?
Yeah, so St. Maximilian Kolbe was born into a small into a family that was like radically Catholic, Polish family that lived in a small town, and that was really modest in terms of like their material possessions, but a very strong family. And he grew up in a very small, if you've ever seen a Polish country home, the cottage, they're basically one hallway with two rooms. One of those rooms is the kitchen. One is the bedroom. But frankly, when you have four children and two adults, you have six people kind of in that, that space. He lived in a very kind of modest, very communal life that was very like interdependent. And, around him was this incredible tapestry of traditions that, are just absolutely gorgeous. He often made pilgrimages to Our Lady of Częstochowa, which is basically the Polish Our Lady of Guadalupe. And it's my favorite depiction of Mary because she's this, this very like somber kind of like almost grieving face that has been battle scarred literally, by, people who've constantly, tried to overtake Poland and, convert it to different religions. So, this icon was literally slashed. It was shot with arrows, tried to be burned. And so all of those scars are still present even in the art of Our Lady of Częstochowa. So he was connected to this tradition of Polish grit that was fighting for its Catholic identity. And that was deeply patriotically instilled in him. And in Poland, you kind of have to understand that like the Polish national identity and the Catholic identity are identical. There is not a separation between them, at least not historically. And so for him, he was a son of Poland and a sort of a militant kind of fighter for Poland in the same way that he was a fighter for the Immaculata. She was sort of a symbol of the Polish identity and really the queen of Poland. And so he grew up in this kind of stew of Catholicism, while at the same time, modern technology and modern culture is starting to come in and really shift the political and the religious identity of Poland. And he's getting to see Freemasonry and fascism to the east, to the west in Germany, and communism to the east in Russia, all growing in a way that's really terrifying to, I think, most of the people in Poland, but certainly to those people of faith who really wanted to maintain the Polish identity. And he was very much used to kind of the legends and tales of, and the history of Germany and Russia both invading. And so he grew up while Poland was trying to free itself from Russia. He went to seminary, and his brother went to fight in that war, and his father was killed going looking for his brother while his brother was missing. So he was very familiar with oppression and with having to stand up for one's faith and for one's identity, and that really drove him. And he became a Franciscan friar, and for him, the battle really was a battle for Catholicism and for the Catholic identity and heart of Poland. And to that end, he made the Militia Immaculata, which was a perhaps the biggest magazine in Poland at the time. Did it with no money and no experience as a printer. He was able to put together one of the biggest friaries in the world from nothing, and one of the most incredible magazine productions that was ever made. They had a million person subscriber base with a daily publication, which just the logistics of that are kind of mind boggling.
It is.
And as a creative, he actually had to, him and his friars actually had to improve upon the current printing press technology in order to continue doing what they dreamed of doing. So they were not just like, people who were writing articles, like these were people who had an amazing ability to think creatively, to solve problems, to engineer issues, to build like the logistics around what they had to do to make a publication of that size. They even went to Japan and expanded there in 1 year, led by Colby. They were able to translate what they were doing into Japanese and make it a publication.
He learned the language too, right?
Yeah. I can't even imagine. If you've ever seen Polish written down, like the amount of consonants, to try and translate Polish, which is one of the hardest languages in the world, to Japanese, which is another one of the hardest languages in the world, I cannot imagine. Mm. They did it in less than 1 year without Google Translate, which is just crazy.
It was a genius. Yeah, just a genius. Yeah.
So, of course, but his story comes to a really intense end as he's offered, the Germans come in, steamroll through Poland with the Blitzkrieg and, basically take over. And he, because his dad was German, he's offered German citizenship,
right.
Which is a moment that I think he knows if he receives it, he gets to stay and he's probably going to be treated well, but in some way he's rejecting the core of him, which is the Polish identity that he's kind of fought for his whole life. So he says no and waits for the visit from the SS, which certainly happens. They bring him to Auschwitz with all of the other political prisoners, POWs, and anyone who's ideologically of in conflict with the fascists, but who is also of influence in Poland, is brought to Auschwitz for not just for extermination, but for the breaking of their spirits.
Yeah, and just a minute. I love it. I love everything you're talking about. I want to take a moment and just step back and say, and just reemphasize to our listeners that his, correct me, right, if I'm wrong, his father was German and his mother was Polish. And so he could have avoided all of this, but because of his national identity, but also because of his love for truth and his love for his people, he stayed the course and he didn't. I mean, that is also mind-boggling because he wasn't ignorant to what the Germans, the Nazis, were doing at the time. And I could imagine many a good man under fear and worries not choosing that road. So I just want to pause and get more of your thoughts regarding that before we dive into his time at Auschwitz there.
I think it's one of the most interesting parts of his life because it's, frankly, it's one of the parts of his life that I relate with the most. I feel like now in our culture, especially men, are being offered a similar devil's bargain all the time.
Amen.
Like it's not like, hey, we're asking you to reject your faith, to publicly denounce your faith and say God is evil or like God doesn't exist. We're just asking you to go along to get along, like just be part of our team, you know? And I know you don't agree with us. We're not even asking you to like publicly say that you agree with us. We're just asking you to say that you're on our team. Mm-hmm. And that's like such a easy, it seems like such an easy thing to go along with, especially when you're thinking about all the good work that he could keep doing. He was already taking care of 2,000 Jewish refugees. He was doing all sorts of things for the town to just help like rebuild it and keep the Polish spirit alive. Like there was so much good that he could do for the Polish underground if he had stayed alive, but he didn't do it. He didn't take the deal. And I think that's a really amazing thing to consider for us men who are out in the world doing jobs that are getting more and more woke, that are requiring more and more sort of, I guess, ascension to ideologies that are counter to Catholicism. They rarely ask for something that's like, I want you to betray your conscience by doing this pagan thing. It's not like they're asking you to eat pork as a Jew. They're just asking you to like keep quiet and keep your head down and just be like anyone else. And that temptation right now, I think, is the most profound temptation that we as men are going to be facing in the next 10 years.
I completely
it's just
agree.
More and more of that.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. And I just want to jump in and say that in total agreement, I think that that is what we have been almost indoctrinated into in our societies. Like, it didn't happen overnight, very socialist, right, in this sort of approach, is that it wasn't something that just we woke up one day and, yeah, this woke agenda, you know, overnight happened to us. No, it was something that steadily has happened over the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. And it's just become almost a part, and we've all experienced it in our immaturity, maybe in high school or in college, where we tried to talk about being Catholic and then we experienced the uncomfortability of maybe not having the answers, or, you know, offending somebody unintentionally, or these sort of things. And then that has just built up in our society. And then you throw mass media at it, right? Where everything that is the control of, you know, one, we'll just say the woke agenda on mass media today. And that's not where I plan on taking this episode, but it's so overwhelming. And so the stuff that's being shown to you and the stuff that you're being digested, you know, is just truly slowly indoctrinating you. And it's something that we have to kind of turn to the silence with God more than the silence, you know, with our neighbor in these situations, if that makes any sense. So I really appreciate you bringing that up.
Yeah, I mean, I'll share a personal story really quick, if that makes sense, that's like relevant to it. I am an example from my own life of like where this kind of thing materialized during the pandemic. My agency, I'm a business owner and run a marketing firm, and my agency at the time, we had 11 people in it, and before the pandemic, it was sort of on this, you know, course up. So we had hired people, and these are people who had moved and who had kids, and it was like a lot to try and take care of them as, like, you know, the economy just sort of fell out from under us. And we got an opportunity to bid on a big commercial project that was a like for a big AI construction sort of technology thing, developed in Silicon Valley, but was like based in Austin, Texas. And there was a Catholic girl who was running the marketing for it. And she saw some of our work and was like, you know, why don't you guys put in a bid? And we knew that if we got this bid, it was like, this was the game changer that would keep our team together for the rest of the year. And it was a really like exciting opportunity for us. So we went all out with the bidding process, like did multiple versions of scripts before they'd even committed to us, and like contributed to a much higher level than an agency normally does before they're actually under contract. And sure enough, like we won the bid. She called us and we all like toasted with champagne. We're all like very excited together. And she was like, we just have to pass it through legal. And then crickets for like a week. And we were like, oh, something must have happened with legal. Mm. And she called me and let me know like what went down. And she was like, hey, the good news is like we were able to work something out to like continue working with you. The bad news is like I have some sort of like awkward news for you. And I was like, okay, what is it? And she said, well, they looked at legal, like did some research on you guys, and they looked at your portfolio and they saw that there was some clientele on there that they didn't feel like had messages that they could really agree with. And they were afraid of some sort of like PR crisis if it got out that their film, that their commercial was like made by people who like disagreed with, you know, that had these controversial opinions. And so we were able to work together, but under the caveat that you guys can't say that you made it and you can't put it on your website and it gets credited as an internal project done by our marketing team. And we were like, you know, this is a really interesting juncture because we stay alive if we stay with it, but there's a way that it feels like we're, you know, silencing ourselves because we're Catholic. Like, we know that what they saw was other Catholic, you know, things on there. They saw like probably saw something for a pro-life, you know, clinic that was a crisis pregnancy center or something, and got really spooked. And so we decided not to take the project, to turn it down, and ultimately to disband the team because we knew that like we wouldn't have anything to come in that could keep us making payroll. And what's really interesting about that is that that actually was when I started working on the feature length script. Wow. Because everything quieted down and I was like, there's no business. I need to be reflecting on something that's beautiful, that gives me hope. And I was drawn to picking the script back up. So it's kind of an interesting, like, you know, connection to the story.
Anthony, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. You know, in the scripture, what does it profit a man to gain the world but to lose his soul? You know, really cuts deep right there. And I think what a tough discernment that you had to make to go between, yeah, feeding and doing families and you know, continuing your business versus, yeah, kind of maybe violating your conscience, as you were saying. And I think, what a heroic move on your part. And so then you're kind of in this, I guess, let me ask you here, are you in this situation of kind of like despair, hopelessness? Is there any that far, or is it more just, you know, disillusionment, depression? You know, now you've got this silence upon you and you decide to start writing about St. Maximilian. I think this is a perfect segue into the beautiful and incredible project you're working on.
Yeah. So there's sort of two different phases of the project. There was kind of like the initial idea back in 2014 when I was, at that time, I was in complete despair. Like I was a professed agnostic during that season of my life. And I was more like, but more intense. I was kind of like, I had more of that bitterness of the atheist going on.
Sure.
But when I started to meditate on this story of Maximilian Kolbe, I began to have this like openness in my heart, not even necessarily to like saying that God is good or that God exists, but just to having this like openness to the person of Christ, who is willing to be with me in my suffering. It was like, that's somebody that I can follow and understand, even if I don't understand how, like, you know, what this whole divinity, you know, supernatural thing is here. And, that led slowly to a reclaiming of my faith that happened over many years. But during that time of reclaiming, one of the high water marks was being asked by the Diocese of Dallas to help them reach people who had left the church with an event. And, in collaboration, we came up with this idea to do a short film about St. Maximilian Kolbe, which became, kind of the proof of concept for this film that we're making right now. And that was done back in 2018. So fast forward to the pandemic, when the company goes belly up, I wouldn't say that I was in despair. I think it already hit like the bottom in a way back in 2014.
Yeah.
But at this time, it was a different kind of like perhaps a despairing in the world, or a like, how do I show up as a Christian when I see the world going in a direction that I feel like is ultimately going to like chew me up and spit me out, you know? And I think that Kolbe became my, like, my example for how to navigate what felt like to me was like an Armageddon for like the Catholic world. That meditation led to writing the feature length script, going to Poland and living with the friars out there to understand him more deeply, and then ultimately to starting to pitch it to investors and raising the money to go and shoot it.
Yeah, praise God. Well, and I appreciate you following through with that thread of inspiration, that thread of hope, and obviously creativity. So were you a writer prior to this, or is this, the first screen, you know, writing that you had ever done? Where does that kind of fall within the line of your life?
Yeah, so I've been a writer all my life. I studied creative writing even when I was in college, but I hadn't done a feature-length script yet. And I had the opportunity to join a group of Hollywood writers who were all doing, you know, secular projects, but who really understood the process of screenwriting. It was kind of a divinely inspired thing. I'm not sure how I ended up in the room, because I was like so beneath the league of these other filmmakers. And frankly, it was like deeply embarrassing showing them things that I was working on. But I stuck with it, and we got to do a couple of table readings of the feature length script of the Colby film with them. And it was just really clear based on how everybody was reacting in those table readings that there was something really powerful here that we should follow and chase down.
Very cool. Yeah, well, and I want to hear about that now. So now we're entering into the life of Auschwitz and St. Maximilian Kolbe. And I'll start by, I don't have the quote memorized, but I know that an individual there who made it out alive stated that within just a couple weeks of getting to know St. Maximilian Kolbe, he went from, you know, this fear of whether he's ever going to see his family and this total despair to almost an excitement and a joy at the thought of dying along with Christ and sacrificing along with Christ for the sake of the world and the sake of these conversions and stuff. And I mean, it's just, it's that level. It sounds almost like a fantasy or something, you know, or something very fictional that there's a man that lived the devotional life so deeply that when he entered into this darkest of you know, hell on earth, he was able to still breathe God's light and love into that place and hope into that place. So I'd love for you to talk about his time there at Auschwitz, but also kind of the unique inspiration for your film and the direction that you decided to take. Because while I appreciate that and I want to hear that, I'll also add in agreement with you that there's a lot of crappy, you know, movies out there that aren't doing a great job of bettering the mission of the church. And I'll say that what I've seen of yours is not at all the case. And so I'm grateful for that, but I'd love for you to kind of talk about all those things.
For sure. Yeah. So we kind of left off on Kolbe's story as he was brought to Auschwitz. He had a really profound effect on the people that he was around, because this is a man who's been prepared for this in a lot of ways his whole life. He's lived in incredibly close communal situations under duress, under crazy stress and work pressure, and fasting the whole time, you know? So Auschwitz in some ways is like, aside from the oppressive people that are trying to break your spirit, like the actual living situation is not that out of the norm for what he's lived. And so he's able to offer this like hope and this kind of endurance to the people around him who are themselves like caving under the pressures and beginning to steal from each other or to like throw themselves on the electric fence or all the sorts of things that the Nazis were trying to do to show them that their humanity was not real, was a fiction. And so Kolbe began in some way through just his example, this kind of game of chicken with the Nazis, where he is, by continuing to be noble and to retain his nobility and his humanity, being like this kind of this rock and pebble in the shoe of the Nazis. Like they can't break his spirit. And ultimately that crescendos into this moment where when the Nazis are, whenever somebody leaves or it goes missing, they would bring all of the people from that bunkhouse or that prison block to a roll call where they would select 10 people at random to die of starvation while they were looking for this person. And if they found the person, then the people would be released. But if they didn't find the person, then they would all die. But of course, most of the time they all died, even if they did find the person, because they all died so quickly.
Yeah.
And so Kolbe volunteers to take the place of one of the men who cries out and says, "I have a wife and children, please, you know, please let me go." Kolbe saves that man's life by volunteering to take his place. The Nazis miraculously allow him to do it, allow him to step out of line without shooting him, which is its own like weird, never ever happened before or after in Auschwitz. Then from inside of the cell, he leads almost like what we've seen in these movies, like Hunger or whatever, like about, you know, starvation strikes.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that, where these men become this they are beginning to pray. They become this sort of like place of revival in the midst of the torture chamber in Auschwitz, literally the darkest place in the darkest place on earth. These people are singing songs, praying, and leading the other people in the cells around them in a revival of their Catholic identity. And of course, their songs begin to like resonate outside of the prison block through these windows. And the other people passing by hear that and realize and kind of return to themselves. Like it wakes their own dignity back up to see other people suffering that way. And ultimately, they were able to stay alive for 14 days until the Nazis had enough of it and decided to execute them with carbolic acid. And Kolbe died the day before the Assumption of Mary, the feast day of the Immaculate. So I think it's just really beautiful that he kind of was able to go and meet her and in some ways be brought up to heaven on the feast day in which she was brought up to heaven. So
truly, without God's grace, it would not be possible. It is absolutely a testament of God's working through the life of an individual, which each of us are called to experience, but his life, you know, prepared him for that and that he was able to. And I love that story that you were talking about where there was these chants and there was these prayers. And I know that the janitor who made it out, thanks be to God, also a miracle, was able to see anytime the door opened, right, that Maximin Kolbe was in the center there on his knees or standing, you know, and just leading these people. And I remember him saying it was almost as if he was in church because of that. I mean, it's mind boggling as well. But I really want to talk about your movie here. And so share with me your movie. Let's talk about The Triumph of the Heart, right, that you are putting forth and the struggle that it was to bring that into existence. I want you to be able to share it all.
Yeah. So we, after we did that short film, the idea of the short film was instead of taking on Kolbe's life from like beginning to end and trying to do the whole thing, which most Saint films unfortunately flounder, I think, for a lot of reasons. But one of them is that like they're trying to tell like the whole history of a person's life. And it's just every life has so many stories inside of it that tends to kind of water down all of them. Yeah. So what we did was we were like, let's just tell his passion from the moment that he steps out of line all the way through his death. How does he engage with these other men in this cell to bring them to that place of hope, knowing that these are people who probably have very different ideologies than him, who have been brought to this kind of like their humanity has been removed from them by the brutality of Auschwitz. How does he bring them to hope and bring them to this place of being able to fight to stay alive? So we did a sort of, if 12 Angry Men meets the Passion of the Christ, what would that look like? Like it's one room where a saint is trying to hold out for life and for hope, while these other people are in question about whether or not they should, you know, commit suicide or not. And, that is the, it's kind of like the place that we go to. And of course it's very dark, but the way that the film progresses, you see these characters begin to come on board with Kolbe and to open up their hearts to him. And slowly a brotherhood develops in the cell as one by one, each one of them kind of has their moment of conversion and comes alongside of him and begins to like join his little militia in the cell to sing to those outside of it and to pray for the people in the cell in Auschwitz. And so that story, along with the flashbacks to their lives and how this moment kind of begins to make sense of all of that, or at least to redeem it. That's really the story that we're telling and the lens through which we're looking at Kolbe's story.
Yeah. Wow. I'm really looking forward to seeing the full movie. I think it is so well done. And I guess that's it. I don't want to just use artistic and to the point where it's not going to captivate all that you have so eloquently laid before us, because I do, in my brief experiences, you know, 18 minutes here, 5 minutes there, you know, et cetera, just really gain that sense of beauty and wonder and awe at who he is. And not like, again, hopelessness, right? Because when you think about watching a whole movie in the cell, I know that you did, you know, there's the flashbacks and the, you know, memories of their past and everything like that. But not to experience, you know, that sort of like darkness and be able to thread that very difficult needle takes a certain degree of grace and talent. Yeah. So I
don't know, you know, it's still like the jury's still out, right? Like, I think that it's still going to be really hard to watch. There's no way around the fact that, like, we have to take you on this kind of descent into hell in order for you to understand the heroism that Colby, you know, displayed. And the question, like, we are playing with gloves for sure. Like, we nerfed down the difficulty of the story tremendously, but it's still going to be difficult to watch, as perhaps The Passion of the Christ was. But this is different in that it's kind of like more psychologically brutal. And I think that's there's a different kind of perhaps even more relatable suffering that's going on there than like the torture of the crucifixion. So certainly don't bring kids that are younger than like 13 to watch it when it comes out, because it is certainly like kind of adult topics. But
I
would love to hear too, you know, I didn't get to talk to you after the event. You got to see the first 6 minutes of the film. Like, what were your thoughts? Obviously you say you feel like, wow, this is authentic. It's like, you know, artistic, but did you feel?
Yeah, I appreciate that question, and I'm happy to share with you. So I'm skeptical anytime I come to one of these events or see one of these movies. I'm just, you know, I am who I am. I pray about that, and I'm looking to be more charitable and more loving. So, but I think that sets the stage, right? I was expecting to not be moved. I was expecting to see something that was a good attempt. You know, and I mean, it is who I am. I am jaded. I think our listeners know that it is all the stuff that I work through and I'm honest about. But that was it, you know, and I was glad to see, you know, a bunch of friends and see you and, you know, and be there. But I don't want to say that it was the people that were there as much as it was the delivery of the message and the way that you guys were not only authentic, but the story that you're telling. And I mean that, like, it's very unique. And I don't want to take away from it. I only want to add to it, because I wasn't expecting to see kind of the flashbacks. I wasn't expecting to not only see my favorite saint, Saint Maximin Kolbe, but also, as you intended to do, the life of the 9 other prisoners there. And truly not just the life of them there, but the life that they had, right? Had that layer of dignity, but that layer of humanity on each of them. And so I was very grateful to have, I told Jeff that right afterwards, that I was really grateful to have come and to have been a part of that and to experience that, and truly excited to have you on the show to do what we can here to help bring this, you know, through Angel Studios. I want to make sure you have time to talk about that, but to more and more people. So that was my, that was my experience in a nutshell.
Yeah. Like to see these, like these mini flashbacks, even the ones that we had in the first 6 minutes that kind of humanized the people in the cell. I would say, I guess it felt like all of a sudden the stakes of Colby's sacrifice became so much more evident to you.
So well stated. Absolutely. That's exactly right. You know, where it wasn't so much, a saint among men, right? As much as it was just that depth of humanity that was given to all of them, right? Because I do think when we read saint stories, we do have this feeling of it's, you know, they were, their lives were unachievable, or everybody else was just, you know, let's call them what's it called in computer generated, you know, characters in their story.
Oh, they're like, yeah. Oh yeah. I know. Yeah, they're the, oh crap. I'm forgetting the name too.
So you get the gist though. Yeah. Yeah. Not a big gamer myself, but you know, they're like these computer generated, you know, characters in the story.
NPCs. They're NPCs.
Yes, exactly. In the story of the saint. But in fact, you know, these were people with real hopes and real dreams and real love and real emotions and in a real life, you know. And I think that just brought this unique tapestry together that's going to make this resonate with so many people and also affect them on a level that remains, right? I always say a good movie is that which you're going to wake up to the next day thinking about, and this has every detail and recipe that they're going to be thinking about it for the next few mornings, which is, you know, an exciting prospect. So, yeah. You know, I know we're 45 minutes in and people are stopping to listen. So I want to make sure that we have time here to share the story. I mean, you were on your own hero's journey. You shot this in Auschwitz. I mean, that itself is miraculous. And, where can people go to learn more, to help you, to support, and to be aware of what's at stake, you know, of getting this out there far and wide?
Yeah, so I think we're at the beginning of a Catholic Renaissance in film. Mm. I think it's like something that is part of why people are so excited about this film. It's not just us, but Cabrini is coming out, and we got to see Father Stu come out before, and there's this sense that like there's a new wave of storytelling that that we're achieving, and. Yeah. Part of the medium for that is our ability to crowdfund things. Like we get to say, even though Hollywood is still doing its thing, we can create a whole different economy just by tapping into, through the power of social media, tapping into our own wallets and doing like $20, $10, like $15 to pre-order a ticket or to say, hey, I just want to see this movie made. That kind of crowdfunding is amazing because it offers the ability to go outside of the industry. Yeah. And so we raised some money beforehand to go and shoot, but it wasn't enough to finish the movie. So now we're in the process of crowdfunding. Hopefully this movie comes out before we're done this week. But if it doesn't, you know, people can still sort of follow along with us after that. But the point is, right now, for people who want to see that renaissance in Catholic film happen, the main things that we have to do are, we have to prove that there's an ecosystem economically viable, an economically viable ecosystem of people that want to see these films made. I think that when we've been in conversations with other distributors, other than Angel Studios, who's a bit of a distinct cat, which I'll talk about in a second, but other studios and other people in the industry are like, you'll never be able to be successful with this film. Please don't do it. People who want to make faith-based movies, they want really, you know, like the God's not dead, fireproof type story. Kevin it's Sorbo. A happy ending, you know, like everything is very like, it's a palatable movie for somebody who wants a good family film at the end of the day. Like that's the market. So like, we know that works. This is not that. Like you have people starving in a cell. It's like hunger, you know, like, it's very intense. That's not like a family-based film that they're going to go and watch on a, you know. So it's like, point is, I think they have a box, and we have to show for them to be able to put $15 million down for like a theatrical release. We have to show them that there's a market for the film. And by ordering or doing a crowdfunding campaign, that market is proven. And every small gift, doesn't matter how big it is, $5, $1, like somebody gave $3, Jeff's daughter gave us $10, you know, like every single one of those gifts is a vote for the movie to be made and to be distributed. And so right now we are in conversations with Angel Studios that did Mother Cabrini. And this crowdfunding campaign is a part of the data that they're collecting to say whether or not they're going to do a theatrical release. So it's going to be really helpful if people are able to contribute even small amounts to be able to help this movie come about.
Amen. So all of those links are going to be in the show notes. You can click on them. They're going to take you right over there so that you can help assist this movie get far and wide. Because again, and I said what's at stake, and I'm going to just bring that up here. I remember you saying not to just the other night that what's at stake is theatrical release. You know, this can get into movie theaters, and Angel Studios could provide the investment, the millions and millions of dollars necessary to do that for God's kingdom, for the goodness of others, and for hope to be shared to those in need, which is frankly pretty much everybody these days. So yeah, any last thoughts on that, just to encourage people to head over?
Yeah, I think that what people are going to experience when they watch this film is an awe, I think, of like what these men were able to experience, and a sense of hope that God can work even in the most brutal and most difficult of circumstances. And I think that Colby's vision of heaven, which is something that he kept to himself his whole life, but that was really clear that he was able to hold on to, that drove him to be able to do these acts of heroism that seem kind of mind-boggling to us. But I think that our own capacity to sacrifice and to all, even to accept our crosses, I think those things are going to really be transformed as we get in touch with this story.
Amen. Well, Anthony, thank you so very much for doing this. Thank you so very much for your ask. Thanks for joining me on the show today. It means a lot. And I just, you're in my prayers. I'm going to call all our listeners to offer up a prayer right now. Click on that link and head over there and donate, or show ways that you can support, even sharing it out on social media. All of those things are incredibly helpful, and it'll mean a lot. And so please do that. Say that, take that yes, and do that. So Anthony, again, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, John. I'm really grateful to hear your own experiences with watching the first 6 minutes of the film. And obviously this like platform is just such a gift to be given to be able to share about the story. So I appreciate you having me on, and I'm looking forward to showing the full movie to you, man.
Awesome. Likewise, I'm looking forward to seeing it. So again, thank you so very much. And for all of our listeners, you know, for Christ in Heaven, Our Lady in Her Glory, and for this movie in St. Maximin Kolbe, please keep us all in your prayers. Be a man, be a saint. Thank you.